From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. President Donald Trump this week compared himself to Dwight D. Eisenhower, a critic of the American military-industrial complex. He cast himself as an anti-war leader who was unpopular with the generals but loved by troops. Trump, who appears to be losing the military vote to his rival Joe Biden, has been attempting to do damage control to his re-election campaign after a damning article in The Atlantic exposed his denigrating remarks toward fallen U.S. soldiers during a 2018 visit to Paris. In fact, under Trump's presidency, top-ranking officials have hailed from the weapons manufacturing industry, and Trump has overseen the escalation of an air war in Afghanistan, the longest official war in U.S. history. My guest is Dr. Stephen Zunis, professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, where he coordinates the program in Middle Eastern Studies. He's also senior policy analyst for Foreign Policy in Focus, a project of the Institute for Policy Studies, and an associate editor of Peace Review. Welcome to the program, Stephen.
Good to be with you.
So it seems as though Trump's claims of being unpopular with the generals is just his way of doing damage control. But he has, through the years, even during his campaign before 2016 election, attempted to be a critic of what he called endless wars, blamed the Obama administration for fueling endless wars. Where does he actually stand on the issue of wars? Because we can't take him at his word, of course.
Certainly. Under the Trump administration, U.S. troop presence in the Middle East has actually gone up from the later years of the Obama administration. He has overseen some of the most dramatic increases in military spending in modern history. And furthermore, he has appointed more generals to more top civilian positions than any president in history. So he is very much in aiming his whole policy approach in a very militaristic direction. So it is ironic that he would try to portray himself who is trying to challenge military influence.
It is quite interesting that he compared himself to Eisenhower. Give us a little bit, a brief history lesson. The term military-industrial complex is one that arose during a speech that Eisenhower made in 1961, near the end of his term, and it became one that was adopted by anti-war activists for many years since.
Well, Eisenhower, being a general, he knew the horrors of war. He was also kind of a fiscal conservative in the kind of the old-fashioned Republican Midwestern tradition, and he really resisted a lot of the big push for increased military spending, direct military intervention overseas. He relied on nuclear deterrence or covert operations such as the CIA. Kennedy, when he ran for president, attacked Eisenhower, and by extension Nixon, Eisenhower's vice president and his Republican opponent, as not spending enough on the military. And he promised to exert U.S. military power even more so. And I think it's something that it has been lost by both parties, because both parties in subsequent years have, with a few exceptions, have tried to outdo each other and their willingness to mortgage much of our future to this exorbitant military spending. I mean, the United States not only spends far more on its military than any country in the world, we spend more per capita than almost any country in the world. And that's despite being between two oceans and two weak and friendly neighbors. So it's the whole thing about the way we've mortgaged our future by spending so much of our resources and our best talents and everything else into the military is something that definitely needs to be discussed. But Trump is hardly the person to raise it.
Right. And then the responses to Trump's claims in the mainstream media are so interesting. You know, they're casting it as an unprecedented attack on the military. On Monday, during his remarks at the White House, a press conference at the White House, he made several claims around being somebody who was beloved by the troops, but the people at the top in the Pentagon didn't like him because, of course, they were more interested in profits that wars bring. And so those words were being cast as an attack on the military. However, didn't the Obama-Biden administration's eagerness, unfortunately, to continue wars make Trump's critiques easier? I mean, they paved the way for this, and you don't see their war hawkishness being raised in the corporate media.
Oh, indeed, Trump owes his victory to the fact that the Democrats nominated a hawkish nominee for president. I mean, he attacked Hillary Clinton from the left, saying disingenuously that he opposed the Iraq war, while Hillary Clinton, accurately, was a major supporter of the war. He said, I'll put America first. I'm going to bring our troops home. And that resonated with a lot of people. In fact, exit polls and other surveys have shown that the biggest shift of voters from Obama in 2008-2012 to Trump in 2016, in those key northern swing states that made the difference in his in Trump's Electoral College victory, that that voting group paralleled almost exactly the communities that experienced the highest casualty rates from America's overseas wars. And the conclusion of these studies was that if Hillary Clinton had not supported the Iraq war, if the Democrats had nominated someone who wasn't seen as so hawkish, the Democrats would have won Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin, and Trump would have never become president.
So what has he actually done? I mentioned the Afghanistan war, and there was a report recently showing that the U.S. actually escalated the Afghanistan war this past year at the same time that it was supposedly signing this, you know, peace agreement with the Taliban. Meanwhile, investigations into civilian deaths at the hands of U.S. Bombs or soldiers have dropped dramatically. So does Trump just think out of sight, out of mind, that we just won't notice?
I'm afraid so. And a lot of people are buying it. I mean, his claim that we are drawing troops from Syria, we basically shifted them from protecting the Kurds to protecting the oil fields in another part of the country. The war effort in Iraq has been less focused towards ISIS, but it's more towards countering Iranian influence. And the fact is insisting on keeping our troops there in Iraq, despite the fact that the Iraqi parliament has voted for the troops to leave.
And in fact, during the recent Republican National Convention, Trump's ordering of the killing of the Iranian general Soleimani was hailed as this huge foreign policy victory, showing the rest of the world who's boss.
He's really trying to have it both ways, acting like he's tougher, but also less inclined to get people to get Americans in harm's way. I mean, the irony is that, you know, his attack on the generals is just interesting in war profiteering or whatever. I mean, yes, there are generals that meet the kind of Curtis LeMay, Jack T. Ripper kind of stereotype. Ironically, Trump ended up appointing a number of these super hawkish generals to high positions in his administration, at least early on. However, the majority of the Pentagon brass actually is somewhat reticent to get into a lot of these wars. In fact, I think a major reason we did not get into a war with Iran was that the generals to do all these war games in various scenarios found it was going to be a lose-lose proposition, however well we know it. The real military-industrial complex is the big corporations like Raytheon, where Trump's very, very cozy with these kinds of guys. It's less the generals who are responsible. So yeah, him trying to come out as this kind of anti-militarist figure by attacking the generals, it shows how disingenuous his policy is, and I think one that frankly will backfire. The big concern, however, is that as with a number of his policies, Biden may make the mistake of attacking Trump from the right, which is going to hurt not just those working class voters in those northern tier swing states that I mentioned, but a lot of people on the left who voted green or didn't vote last time are thinking, well, maybe this time I will vote for the Democrat, given what's at stake. He's going to alienate a lot of those folks as well. And indeed, a whole bunch of these Republican defections to Obama have been from the very hawkish kind of people that Trump has railed against. And so I think it's that might win him a little Biden a little bit of the, say, Episcopalian vote or those who are the more conservative establishment kind of thing, but who are very influential, I guess you could say, in terms of official Washington and the mainstream media. But in terms of rank and file voters, it's not, you know, Biden is going to really have to go out of his way to stake a more a less interventionist and less militaristic agenda, or else it's going to end up working in Trump's favor, just like it did back in 2016.
Just to go pick up on what you were saying around Trump's coziness with arms manufacturers, it was Trump who appointed Mark Esper, the biggest Raytheon lobbyist, to the position of defense secretary. So Biden and his friendship with John McCain, a hawkish Republican, was a big portion of the Democratic National Convention. Trump has made it very clear. In fact, on Monday during his Labor Day White House remarks to press, he made very clear that he didn't like John McCain. Does John McCain become the sort of proxy symbol of where the Democratic and the Republican nominees lie on the issue of war and foreign policy?
I hope not, because, you know, McCain, again, was one of the most hawkish figures in Congress. He didn't, it's hard to see him find a war that he didn't like. I think what Biden seems to be missing, and I think what Trump is picking up, is that there's been a huge shift in public opinion on the questions of U.S. foreign intervention. You have both kind of a libertarian America First streak in Republicans and more conservative leaning independents, but you also, you know, have a much more dovish anti-war sentiment. That segment of the Democratic Party is growing quite a bit as well. And, you know, the Democrats seem to be falling over themselves to try to get support of some of the more mainstream kind of Republican people on to get them on their side on national security issues. But in doing so, they're going to alienate a good chunk of their own base, as well as an important block of swing voters, which Democrats are absolutely going to need if they're going to defeat Trump in November.
Stephen, do you feel that because our country today is just such a, I don't know, let's put it indelicately, crap show with the perfect storm of the coronavirus pandemic, all of the things that the Trump administration has wrought, that people just aren't paying that much attention to what the U.S. is doing outside the U.S. Compared to what they used to. I mean, it was always difficult. It was always challenging to get mainstream Americans to care about what our soldiers were doing, what our tax dollars were doing in other countries, the destruction they were wreaking. But it seems as though these last 4 years, except in moments where Trump wanted to shine the spotlight, say, toward North Korea or the strike against Iran, it just hasn't been much of an issue.
Foreign policy is pretty low on the agenda to most voters, particularly this round. At the same time, given the very real threats to our country from COVID, from climate change, which we're seeing a number of natural disasters that have been unfolding in various parts of the country and other things, so much of it comes down to is money, that we desperately need a fusion of a lot of money from the federal government to meet people's basic needs, given the depth of the recession, and the needs in public health, of course, which are very obvious. The COVID pandemic has made clear, and of course, in terms of climate change, and because of the money that is needed for these very real necessities, which more and more Americans are recognizing are needed. We just can't afford this huge network of hundreds of overseas bases and hundreds of thousands of troops, you know, stationed around the world, and not to mention these wasteful weapons programs that are building weapons and weapon systems that we really don't need by any objective measure. This is where the link is going to be, which I think is going to force Americans to start to demand a reprioritization and demand that whoever is president stop spending so much on this rat hole of the military and start really focusing on needs here at home.
What about Biden's choice of Kamala Harris as his vice presidential pick? One of the issues that hasn't, again, gotten very much attention during this campaign in particular has been the positions of the two nominees on Israel. Kamala Harris is one who, and of course Biden, both of them are very pro-Israel. Trump, of course, is virulently pro-Israel. He's more pro-Israel than the most pro-Israel of leaders. But of course, it's generally speaking a political tool for him, because he also ironically has large numbers of anti-Semitic people as his supporters. So among his supporters. So do you see the issue of Israel and Palestine as being an interesting point again, where there's this huge blind spot in the corporate media and likely will not be raised, say, during the presidential debates?
It may indeed be avoided in the presidential debate, but unfortunately for the Biden-Harris campaign, it's something that has really upset a lot of people in their base. I mean, 80% of the Democrats, for example, believe that U.S. aid to Israel, like to any country, should be dependent on their government's behavior. Yet Biden and Harris have both explicitly ruled out conditioning more than $3 billion of taxpayer-funded military support to Israel to anything that the Netanyahu government does. Similarly, when it comes to issues around the settlements and around the Israeli occupation, the public in general, particularly Democrats, are far far more liberal positions than do Harris and Biden, who, in both their Senate careers, were among the most hawkish members of Congress, not just among Democrats, but overall when it comes to Israel. Harris bragged that her first bill she ever co-sponsored was siding with Trump against Obama on the question of Israeli settlements, and basically attacking the United Nations, saying it had should butt out of having anything to do with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. As if the United Nations somehow should not play a role in a major international dispute. It's going to be a point of contention. I mean, this would be similar in many ways to when you see some of the great battles on foreign policy over the years, the nuclear freeze, Central America, Iraq. You know, when you have the nominees of both parties taking out positions that are well to the right of most Americans, I think it just adds to the level of alienation that many people have. And this is, this is an election where turnout enthusiasm is going to really make the difference. And we know how enthusiastic Trump supporters are. So it's concerning that the Biden campaign has taken a number of positions on foreign policy, including on Israel and Palestine, that are so alienating to the majority of their constituents.
Just like the Biden-Harris ticket appears to want to capture Republican moderate voters when it comes to the issue of foreign policy, do you also feel that they're doing the same thing on the issue of economic justice, which is related to foreign policy in that we spend too many of our tax dollars on the U.S. military? And it seems as though the Democrats, who do want to cast themselves as being much more generous when it comes to spending taxpayer dollars on Americans, still find the idea of touching the military budget to be anathema, with the exception of, people like Bernie Sanders, who I believe has now gone back to calling himself an independent, and a handful of other Democrats in the House and Senate.
Yeah. This continues to surprise me that this is not more more of an issue because they, really the United States we could be like Europe and we could be like Canada, we could be like some of the emerging economies of East Asia, and that we could have a good solid infrastructure, we could have affordable higher education, we could have universal health care, we have the money for that, but both the inequitable tax structure and high military spending has made that impossible. And I think one thing that people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and some others raised during the campaign is a question of, you know, why not? You know, why can't we have these things that other countries have? You know, when I was growing up and when I visited, when I went outside the United States, I could tell you that these countries were not as developed in many ways as the U.S. was. We were the richest country in the world. We had the best infrastructure, everything like this. And nowadays, when I travel abroad, when I see all the high-speed rail and high-speed internet and the lack of the absence of homeless people on the streets and, you know, things like that. I mean, people don't, I think it was Thomas Friedman, ironically, who observed that Americans don't travel abroad enough to see how far behind we're getting. And indeed, that's exactly what's happening. And it's the high military spending that is a major component of it. And but, you know, I think going back to Eisenhower again, I mean, in another speech, what Eisenhower, you know, said was that this kind of a push towards war will continue unless the people rise up and demand that it ends.
Well, Stephen, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Always a pleasure to have you on our program.
Likewise.
My guest has been Dr. Stephen Zunis, a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco. And we've been discussing the issue of foreign policy in the race for the 2020 presidency. And I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.